fire. Took the kids to the park and disappeared by half past nine. Who'll ever know how much she loved them so? That dark night alone in America. A quiet voice singing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and the slant here of the free.
You're listening to KPFK 90.7 FM, Los Angeles.
I'm Scott Baba. President Trump visits China to discuss trade. The U.S. Senate fails to pass a War Powers Act to curb the war in Iran. Redistricting fights in states across the country continue. These stories and more coming up from the studios of KPFA in Berkeley. This is the Pacifica Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. Russia has launched a massive daytime drone attack on Ukraine, firing at least 800 drones across 20 regions of the country. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said at least six people were killed and dozens wounded, including children. Today's attack included the cities of Kyiv, Lviv, Odessa. Zelensky warned of possible cruise and ballistic missile attacks by Moscow following the drone barrage. Zelensky accused Russia of deliberately targeting railway and civilian sites. Despite Ukraine's recent military successes, Moscow's attacks remain relentless. U.S. President Donald Trump and Russian President Vladimir Putin both said the war could be nearing an end, though they provided no evidence. Ukraine's drone technology has helped shift the war's dynamics, disrupting Russian energy facilities and slowing Russia's advance. Meanwhile, Russia's lower house of parliament approved legislation today allowing President Putin to deploy Russian troops abroad to protect citizens facing arrest, prosecution, or alleged mistreatment by foreign governments or international bodies. Supporters of the bill said it was needed to shield Russians from what Moscow describes as politically motivated actions by Western countries and international courts. State Duma Chairman Vyacheslav Volodin accused Western institutions of using justice systems to punish dissent from European policies. Moscow has long justified its 2022 invasion of Ukraine by claiming it was protecting Russian-speaking populations. The legislation now heads to Putin, who has 14 days to sign it into law. Ukraine condemned the measure as an attempt to legitimize future military intervention. Ukrainian Foreign Ministry spokesperson Hyori Tyiki called the bill, quote, aggressively lawless, and said it normalized the use of force abroad. Western officials have increasingly warned that Russia poses a threat to regional security. And this year, a number of European intelligence agencies labeled Russia as a direct threat to NATO. EU defense officials say Russia may view the current moment as an ideal time to test the military alliance, with U.S. President Donald Trump cutting resources to member states that displease him and threatening to withdraw the United States from the group entirely. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office said that he secretly visited the United Arab Emirates during the Iran war. His office said today that Netanyahu met with UAE President Sheikh Mohammed bin Zayed Al Nahyan during the visit. It added that the visit, quote, resulted in a historic breakthrough in relations between Israel and the United Arab Emirates. The announcement comes just a day after U.S. Ambassador to Israel Mike Huckabee revealed that Israel had sent Iron Dome air defense weapons to the UAE, along with personnel to operate them. However, the United Arab Emirates Foreign Ministry denied Israel's statement, releasing its own statement that emphasized that the Emirati relations with Israel are public and transparent, saying, quote, any claims regarding unannounced visits or undisclosed arrangements are entirely unfounded unless officially announced by the relevant authorities in the UAE. A representative for U.S. President Donald Trump's International Board of Peace overseeing the Israel-Hamas ceasefire said the stalled Gaza ceasefire has failed to meet expectations of both Israelis and Palestinians. The Associated Press's Julie Walker reports.
Nikolai Mladenov, overseeing the U.S. brokered ceasefire in Gaza, says the truce hinges on Hamas's disarmament, that issue stalling rebuilding efforts in the enclave.
We're not asking Hamas to disappear as a political movement. A political party that disavows armed activity can compete in national Palestinian elections.
International mediators agree it's crucial to the ceasefire. Hamas linking disarmament to Israeli troop withdrawals, but no significant progress has been made. Meanwhile, Mladenov noting dire conditions for Gaza's 2 million residents and accusing both sides of ceasefire violations.
There are violations every day, and some of them are very serious.
And criticizing Hamas for consolidating power, but says they could play a role in post-war Gaza if they disarm. I'm Julie Walker.
Israeli drones struck three vehicles on a highway south of Beirut in Lebanon, killing at least 8 people, including a woman and her 2 children. That's according to the Lebanese health ministry. The Israeli military said it targeted Hezbollah infrastructure in southern Lebanon. This comes after residents of 6 southern villages were told to evacuate. Lebanon and Israel are set to hold direct talks in Washington on Thursday. The health ministry confirmed the strikes, but it didn't detail the number of people in each vehicle. The attacks occurred despite a U.S.-brokered ceasefire that began on April 17th. The conflict has resulted in significant casualties. President Donald Trump arrived in Beijing today for what many are calling a, quote, high-stakes summit with China's leader Xi Jinping. Trump is saying he'll focus on trade issues, but he may not be in a position to push for any big wins on that issue. Christopher Martinez reports.
President Donald Trump was greeted by 300 children waving Chinese and U.S. flags and chanting warm welcome as he arrived in Beijing for his much-awaited bilateral summit with Chinese President Xi Jinping. As he left the White House Tuesday, Trump had told reporters, "We're the 2 superpowers. We're the strongest nation on earth in terms of military. China's considered second." But Trump's visit comes at a delicate time for his presidency, with his popularity in the U.S. plummeting and his war on Iran dragging on with no sign of resolution. That means Trump may not have the bargaining leverage he had hoped for. Even so, back in the United States, Republican House Speaker Mike Johnson says Trump is laying down a marker that the American people are not going to be taken advantage of. He says he's hoping for the best.
So our prayers are with him, and he has a good visit with Xi in China. They come forward with some favorable policies and things that will help us out, and I believe he will, and we'll see how that develops. Yeah.
The 2 leaders are expected to discuss a variety of issues, including fentanyl, artificial intelligence, and trade in rare earths. Tariffs and trade relations are on the agenda, with Trump hoping to secure a win with deals for China to buy more American food and aircraft. Trump was joined in the visit by business CEOs, including former special government employee Elon Musk. As for the war on Iran, that is a question mark. Trump has said he expects it to be a topic, but he's also said he does not expect to discuss it because he has it under control. As for China, it unveiled a list of topics ahead of the meeting that it considers off the table. One is the right of countries to have a nuclear program. Another is Taiwan, which China claims as part of the country. President Trump is now saying the main focus of the meetings will be on trade. On that, the final result is likely to be something less than a breakthrough. James Zimmerman is with the American Chamber of Commerce China.
The key thing is that there's no expectations of a grand bargain, no expectations of any kind of breakthrough with, you know, all of the challenges that we have in the trade relationship with China. But what we can expect is that with the two leaders meeting, you know, that does give business a sense of confidence. It gives business a sense of optimism that we have an ongoing dialogue and that we're the two leaders meeting.
Altogether, while Trump has pitched the meeting as a monumental event, some observers are now seeing it as more of a shrinking summit, as a former Bush administration official put it. Reporting for Pacifica Radio News KPFA, I'm Christopher Martinez.
Gunfire broke out in the Philippine Senate today when authorities tried to arrest a lawmaker accused by the International Criminal Court of committing crimes against humanity while he was serving former Philippine President Rodrigo Duterte. And the AP's Charles de Ledesma filed this report.
Security officials gather after a burst of gunfire rang out on Wednesday night in the Philippine Senate, where authorities have tried to arrest a senator wanted by the International Criminal Court for a charge of crime against humanity. It wasn't immediately clear what set off the gunfire or if there were injuries in the Senate, where Senator Ronald De La Rosa has stayed in protective custody by allied senators as Philippine authorities try to arrest him. On Monday, the ICC unsealed an arrest warrant for De La Rosa, a former national police chief who worked on President Rodrigo Duterte's anti-drug crackdowns, in which thousands of mostly petty suspects were killed. The warrant charges De La Rosa with the crime against humanity of murder of no less than 32 persons between July 2016 and the end of April 2018, when under Duterte. I'm Charles de Ledesma.
French authorities have ordered over 1,700 passengers and crew on a British cruise ship to stay on board due to a gastrointestinal illness outbreak. The Ambition, on a 14-night cruise from Belfast to Liverpool, reached Bordeaux on Tuesday. Up to 50 passengers showed symptoms, and those affected were isolated. A medical team is investigating the cause. The outbreak is not linked to the recent hantavirus incident on another ship. The operator of that cruise ship, which is at the center of a hantavirus outbreak worldwide, has said he expects to know by the end of the week if the vessel will keep to its schedule for the coming months. Oceanwide Expeditions previously indicated it would. The Dutch-flagged MV Hondius is listed on the company's website as scheduled to depart on a cruise later in May that would take it to the Arctic for a series of cruises throughout the summer. Three of the ship's passengers died in an outbreak of hantavirus that was first confirmed earlier this month while the vessel was in the Atlantic. In all, there have been 9 confirmed and 2 suspected cases in the outbreak. 18 passengers from the cruise ship stricken by hantavirus are back in the U.S. and being monitored at health facilities in Nebraska and Atlanta. One in Nebraska has tested positive and one in Atlanta is experiencing symptoms. Health officials say the risk to the public is low. Max Pringle reports.
The hantavirus is usually spread from rodent droppings, but can be spread between humans. Passengers aboard the MV Hondius cruise ship contracted the disease last month. 3 people have since died. Several others are sick. Dr. Brian Christine is with the Department of Health and Human Services. He spoke at a press conference in Nebraska.
Let me be crystal clear. The risk of hantavirus to the general public remains very, very low. The Andes variant of this virus does not spread easily, and it requires prolonged close contact with someone who is already symptomatic. Even so, we have taken this situation very seriously from the very start.
Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen said state and federal officials have taken every precaution to make sure the ship's passengers are being quarantined safely.
There is a strong plan in place, and to ensure the folks are secure for their initial assessment, and we're working diligently to ensure no one leaves this security in an unsecured way at an inappropriate time. No one who poses a risk to public health is walking out the front door of the streets of Omaha or beyond.
Health officials were quick to point out that hantavirus symptoms are similar to the flu. So, they say, people displaying symptoms now are not necessarily infected with the hantavirus. Dr. Brendan Jackson is with the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention.
We're going to expect to see people have symptoms. That's just, you know, if you think in any given week or month, how many times do you experience some level of nasal congestion or upset stomach or something? We're being very, very liberal in how we're framing symptoms and monitoring for symptoms here. And so that's how the system is working. It doesn't necessarily mean just because someone has symptoms that they're going to end up having this illness.
Over the weekend, United Nations World Health Organization Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus flew to Tenerife in the Canary Islands, where passengers were first kept after leaving the ship. He said there is cause for concern, but very little chance of a COVID-like outbreak.
People will have questions, people will have concerns, and that's what I tried to address in my message to the people of Tenerife. We hear you, we understand, but the situation is much better now. And the other advantage is the nature of the disease as well. So that's why also I came here, to be on the side of the people.
The cruise ship MV Hondius will remain docked at the Granadilla port in Tenerife in the Canary Islands until local health officials are sure that the situation is safe before it continues on to its final destination in Rotterdam in the Netherlands. For KPFA News, I'm Max Pringle.
South Africa is experiencing a renewed wave of xenophobic attacks targeting African migrants, particularly in major cities such as Johannesburg and Durban, with incidents also reported in KwaZulu-Natal and the Eastern Cape. Vigilante groups have been raiding migrant-owned shops, removing foreign patients from public hospitals, and assaulting individuals in townships, accusing them of taking jobs and straining public services. From Makonda in the Eastern Cape, Garakai Chanza reports.
A group calling itself March and March has led protests against undocumented migrants, starting with a petition at the union buildings in Pretoria before spreading to high-density areas in Johannesburg. The group is demanding mass deportations and has issued an ultimatum to the government. The group's leader, Ngobese Zuma, says they want immediate action.
We want illegal migrants deported from this country. We want to clean up and rebuild South Africa. We want our schools to only enroll South African kids. We are tired of schools that are full of foreigners who are undocumented. We want our people to be employed and to be put first in everything in this country. We cannot be outsiders of our economy. We want to participate. So we want intervention of the government to make this a state of emergency.
Tensions have intensified ahead of local government elections later this year, with political rhetoric increasingly focusing on immigration. Parliamentary discussions have also extended into higher education, raising concerns about employment of foreign academics and fueling fears of institutional exclusion. The Portfolio Committee on Higher Education, chaired by Tebeko Letse, is now seeking clarity from institutions.
So we say, do we have foreign nationals? Then you go to which department? What is the position? Is that a critical skill? We have given them a format for them to just fill in those things. And then we're asking them to give it to us. We will analyze it ourselves and then ask each individual institution, if we find that you have hired a foreign national on a critical skills list, how did that happen?
In recent weeks, local residents have shut down markets run by foreign nationals and in some cases harassed migrants, accusing them of undermining local livelihoods. Most of those affected are Ghanaian nationals. A viral video showing attacks on Ghanaians has drawn international attention, prompting Ghana to summon South Africa's ambassador and demand protection for its citizens. Ghana's Foreign Affairs Minister Samuel Okudzeto Ablakwa says the attacks are unacceptable.
It is really regrettable that at this time, in this modern era, we will see such hatred, such xenophobia against each other, against Africans. It is totally unacceptable. It is condemnable, and we demand from the South African government to protect our citizens and to keep them safe, because they owe them that duty of care.
South Africa's President Cyril Ramaphosa, speaking during Freedom Day commemorations, acknowledged concerns about migration but cautioned against xenophobia, reminding citizens of the solidarity African countries showed during the anti-apartheid struggle.
When the apartheid government was pursuing our liberation fighters, they ran to a number of countries around the world, but especially on our continent. They shared their stories with our neighbors, and our neighbors shared their spaces with them, and they gave them safety. They even fed them. They gave them bread, and they opened their homes. They spoke for us when we could not speak for ourselves. They took risks so that we could be free. Their countries were bombed. Their nationals were killed. And all that they did for our sake as well.
Government spokesperson Crispin Peary says while concerns over illegal immigration should be taken seriously, vigilantism must be stopped.
Where there are concerns of illegal immigration, we have to take them seriously. And where we're able to receive petitions from individuals petitioning this type of conduct, we welcome that. What we are concerned about is people taking the law into their own hands and acts of vigilantism, randomly finding people on the street and then asking them to produce documents. We think that's an element which we need to nip in the bud.
At the international level, United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres has called for the protection of migrants and stronger social cohesion. However, reports of inconsistent policing and inaction during attacks continue to raise concerns, with migrants from countries such as Zimbabwe and Ghana saying they are living in fear. These developments mirror earlier outbreaks of violence, including the 2008 xenophobic attacks and later incidents in 2015 and 2019. Analysts say such attacks often escalate during election period when anti-immigrant rhetoric increases. South Africa has long attracted migrants from across the continent due to its relatively stronger economy. However, persistent poverty, unemployment, and deep inequality rooted in the legacy of apartheid remain unresolved. Critics argue that successive governments have struggled to address these structural challenges and often shift blame onto migrants, using immigration as a convenient explanation for socioeconomic challenges. For KPFA Pacifica Radio in Makanda, Eastern Cape, South Africa, this is Garikai Chaunza reporting.
We'll be back with more news in a moment, but first, we are in the middle of a fun drive. I'm here with News Director Lauren Schmidt asking you to donate what you can to help us continue to bring you the news that is so important right now. Lauren?
Absolutely. You know, independent journalism, like we just heard tonight from our stringer in South Africa, Garikai Chaunza, survives because of you. It survives because ordinary people decide it's worth protecting. Reporting on attacks targeting immigrants in South Africa is barely being covered in much of U.S. media, yet those stories mirror many of the same concerns we're hearing here at home involving ICE operations and immigration enforcement across California and the United States. And that kind of journalism matters. It matters because corporate media too often overlooks stories affecting working class communities, immigrants, and marginalized folks around the world. And here in the KPFA newsroom, we make the decision every day to continue covering those stories because we believe listeners deserve reporting with context, humanity, and accountability. And we are, in fact, in the second week of our spring drive, trying to ensure that we keep this valuable resource on the air, asking folks to become a member of this valued station. Do not pass the buck. Join us in our membership, and you can do that by going to kpfa.org or by calling 1-800-439-5732. That's 800 Hey KPFA. You know, earlier in this week during our drive, I'm proud to report that despite concerns whether we would meet our fundraising goals during the last two newscasts, we did a Hail Mary and actually did. And I think that says something powerful about this community, about the value listeners place on keeping this newsroom on the air. And that is exactly why we're doing a pitch a little earlier in the newscast to give folks the opportunity to go to kpfa.org or call 1-800-439-5732. That's 800 Hey KPFA. And to sweeten the deal, we have another challenge match, a generous $500 match from Doug in Oakland. Thank you so much, Doug. Meaning your donation is doubled during this Pacifica evening news hour. So folks, we're asking you to help us unlock this match and keep these microphones powered. Every amount counts. It's like tributaries into the news stream here. If you can give big, give big. If you can give small, but please give. You can even become a sustainer at $5, $10, $15 a month. Sustainers, of course, help keep the station stable and independent year round. It truly is extraordinary that a community funded station can continue producing this kind of journalism in an era when local newsrooms across the country are disappearing. We refuse to let that happen, but we can only continue doing this work because you keep us here. And this year, your support matters more than ever. So folks, zero callers on the line, zero folks on the donation page. We are asking you to step up. Do not pass the buck. Go to kpfa.org or call 800-439-5732. That's 800 Hey KPFA. And we'll go back to some news and update on how we are trying to meet this goal.
All righty. A seventh war powers vote was brought to the Senate floor, and for the seventh time, senators rejected a Democratic attempt to exercise Congress's constitutional war powers authority. Lauren Schmidt reports.
Will Congress embrace and exercise its constitutional responsibility to decide the question of war?
No, was the answer to Oregon Democrat Jeff Merkley's opening question as he addressed the Senate chamber while bringing the latest war powers resolution to a vote. However, unlike the previous six votes, today's effort saw growing Republican support, resulting in a narrow 49-50 split. Under the 1973 War Powers Act, Congress can require the president to end U.S. military involvement in conflicts not formally authorized by Congress within 60 days, unless lawmakers approve an extension or declare war.
Many colleagues across the aisle have said we will give the benefit of the doubt to the president's contention that there was an imminent threat, but we will reconsider our position when the 60 days have expired. Well, my friends, the 60 days expired on May 1st. We are way past that deadline. Now, the president has a new excuse. He says, well, we are no longer conducting acts of war. We're in a ceasefire. But what matters is the facts on the ground. Are we, in fact, have we, in fact, suspended all the acts of war? No, we have not. We are still engaged on a daily basis. The United States is still blockading Iranian ports. That is an act of war. We're still firing on Iranian warships. That is an act of war. We're still firing on Iranian vessels. It's an act of war. Iran is still blockading the Straits of Hormuz. It's an act of war. They're still firing on U.S. naval vessels. That is an act of war. They're still attacking U.S.-flagged tankers. It is an act of war. Both sides are engaged in a daily war as defined by international law.
Today marked the first vote since the expiration of the War Powers Act timeframe. Now 74 days into Operation Epic Fury.
60 days is up. So will you or will you not honor your constitutional responsibility? That is the question that will be in the vote today.
The lone dissenting voice speaking against the resolution during the vote was John Barrasso, Senate Majority Whip of Wyoming, who berated Democrats.
Mr. President, what they're doing, the Democrats are doing, is not about protecting the Constitution. It is about obstructing the President of the United States. That's what's happening here today. That's exactly what Democrats are trying to do.
He criticized Democrats for not curtailing former President Barack Obama's military actions in Libya and disagreed with the characterization that the United States remains at war.
President Trump has complied with the law. Enforcing a blockade is not the same as active hostilities under the War Powers Act.
However, Lisa Murkowski disagreed. She was one of three Republicans to vote with Democrats. At yesterday's subcommittee hearing on the proposed military budget for 2027, Murkowski said the law is straightforward.
The War Powers Resolution is pretty clear here. It requires the president to terminate hostilities within 60 days, absent congressional authorization. I think it's important that we in Congress assert our own role and responsibility to this. That 60-day clock expired April 28th.
Lisa Murkowski pointed to the continued military buildup in the region and asked Secretary of War Pete Hegseth whether the Trump administration intends to ever seek congressional approval.
I think where there is confusion is when the president says hostilities have ended, we still have 15,000 troops that are forward deployed, more than 20 warships in an active naval blockade. CENTCOM has redirected 61 commercial vessels, disabled tankers. In other words, it doesn't appear that hostilities have ended. And so the question to you is whether or not the administration has considered or had intended to seek an authorization of use of military force from the Congress.
Senator, our view is that should the president make the decision to recommence, that we would have all the authorities necessary to do so.
Do you think that it would be helpful to the president if it was made clear that, in fact, the Congress did provide an AUMF?
I think the president, our view is that he has all the authorities he needs under Article 2.
Principal architect of the United States Constitution, James Madison, was clear that the power to declare war belonged to the people's branch in Congress, stating, quote, "The executive is the branch of power most interested in war and most prone to it," close quote. A principal Democrats say Congress is failing to uphold, warning the biggest cost of all may be Congress not asserting its power. For KPFA News, I'm Lauren Schmidt.
President Donald Trump's efforts to redraw voting maps to favor Republicans in this year's midterm elections are drawing mixed results. In South Carolina, senators defied his push yesterday, while Missouri's top court upheld a new map backed by Trump. Lisa Dwyer has more.
The Republican push for South Carolina to join the national redistricting battle has fizzled after an initial vote in the state Senate fell short. President Donald Trump had urged South Carolina to redraw its U.S. House map ahead of the November elections. The state House had previously voted in favor of letting lawmakers return after the regular session ends this week to consider redistricting. But the Senate also had to approve taking up redistricting. The 29-17 vote failed with just two votes short of the two-thirds needed. Five Republicans joined all the Democrats in the chamber to reject the proposal. I'm Lisa Dwyer.
The Democratic primary for a key U.S. House seat in Nebraska is too early to call. As of late yesterday, two candidates were separated by a narrow margin in a contest that could decide the fate of the state's so-called blue dot. Political activist Denise Powell had a lead of about 2 percentage points over State Senator John Kavanaugh out of more than 51,000 votes counted. The district draws national attention because Nebraska is one of just two states that splits its electoral votes. In the U.S. Senate race, incumbent Pete Ricketts won the GOP primary, and Cindy Burbank won the Democratic primary. In the governor's race, incumbent GOP Governor Jim Pillen won his primary, while former state senator Leanne Walls won the Democratic nomination. Meanwhile, the race for West Virginia's 1st congressional district, Vince George has won the Democratic nomination for his House seat. A plaintiff in the landmark Alabama redistricting case said she is devastated after the U.S. Supreme Court cleared the way for the state to redraw congressional maps just days before the May 19th primary. Tramell Gomes reports.
The Supreme Court's 6-3 order cited its recent ruling weakening the Voting Rights Act and vacated a lower court injunction that had blocked Alabama from changing its maps until 2030. Letitia Daniels-Jackson, one of the plaintiffs in Allen v. Milligan, says the ruling interferes with an election already underway.
We're seeing in real time an interference with the current execution of a primary election, and I'm devastated by that. Because it seems that new rules are being written that actually overturns decades of precedent.
Jackson notes that military and absentee voters have already cast ballots. State officials defend the new map as lawful. The Supreme Court's order cites Louisiana v. Callis, which significantly weakened Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act by requiring plaintiffs to prove intentional discrimination, a much higher legal bar. The plaintiffs have filed for a temporary restraining order to keep the current court-ordered map in place for the May 19th primary. Jackson says the ruling sends a clear message to black Alabamians.
It is basically sending us back pre-Voting Rights Act, where we actually have no hope whatsoever to have fair representation and to have a voice in the governance of our cities, of our state, and of our country.
Black Alabamians make up more than 27% of the state's population, but have only one majority black congressional district out of seven. Governor Kay Ivey has called special primary elections for August under the newly allowed map invoking House Bill 1. But that law faces a potential legal challenge. Alabama voters approved a constitutional amendment in 2022 that said as election changes cannot occur within 6 months of the general election. HB 1 was signed on May 8th, less than 6 months before the November 3rd general election. This is Tramell Gomes for Alabama News Service.
The Senate confirmed Kevin Warsh as chairman of the Federal Reserve today in a 54-45 vote along mostly party lines, installing a former Fed official to lead the central bank at a fraught moment for the global economy. Warsh is a former Federal Reserve governor and will replace Jerome Powell as chair as policymakers grapple with elevated inflation, divided views on interest rates, and renewed scrutiny over the Fed's independence under President Donald Trump. Trump repeatedly attacked Powell for not cutting interest rates. Trump also sought to fire Fed Governor Lisa Cook and launched an investigation into Powell over Senate testimony on a building renovation. Warsh has been highly critical of the Fed's recent track record under Powell, particularly the most post-pandemic inflation spike during the Biden administration, which was the worst in four decades. He also called for limiting the Fed's communications, which would be a sharp shift after decades of growing transparency. He has argued that some of its communication tools, such as quarterly forecasts of where its key rate may head, have made it harder for officials to switch gears when needed. Senate Democrats also condemned Warsh for not fully divulging the details of his wealth, which amounts to at least $100 million. His investments include stakes in Polymarket and SpaceX, but he has not revealed the size of those holdings. He did promise to sell all such assets within 90 days of being sworn in. Grocery prices jumped sharply last month, with U.S. consumers paying 0.7% more in April for food at home, according to new data from the Bureau of Labor Statistics released this week. It's the biggest one-month increase in grocery prices in nearly 4 years. The rise marks a reversal from March's 0.2% decline and pushes overall grocery-related inflation to 2.9% over the past year, intensifying pressure on household budgets. Fresh vegetables saw some of the steepest increases, with prices more than 40% higher than 3 months earlier on an annualized basis. Coffee and beef also surged roughly 20% each, driven by supply disruptions, high energy and fuel costs, and global weather-related shortages. Economists say the increases are hitting lower-income households hardest as inflation outpaces wage growth. While overall consumer spending remains steady, data released by Bank of America shows widening K-shaped trends, with higher-income Americans continuing to spend while lower-income consumers cut back on essentials and discretionary purchases. Analysts warn persistent food inflation could keep interest rates elevated longer, adding further strain to consumers already facing higher borrowing costs. We'll be back with more news in a moment, but first, we wanted to get back to that fund drive and ask you once again to help us help to pay for the news and the original coverage and everything that this station puts out to help you stay informed and participate in society as responsibly as you can. And if you want to help us make that, make those funding goals and how you want to donate to us, you can call 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also go on kpfa.org. I'm here with our news director, Lauren Schmidt. Lauren?
Absolutely, Scott. And it's hard to ask for folks to contribute and to donate, especially after a story like that, where if you like caffeine or eat food or drive to work, life has become increasingly expensive. And except for the 1%, I think everybody is feeling it. So it is hard to ask you for support, but it is your support. What is needed to keep this vital station on the air, to power these microphones? That's why we ask that a $5, $10, $15 donation, when we exercise collective power, it all contributes to this greater goal. Tonight, we do have a $500 match from Doug in Oakland. Thank you so much, Doug. And we are 1/4 of the way there. Thank you to Anonymous in Los Gatos, Anonymous in Sebastopol, and Barnaby in Santa Cruz. Thank you so much for going to kpfa.org and making a donation, becoming a member. You can also call 1-800-439-5732. That's 800-HEY-KPFA. We have excellent volunteers, very friendly, excellent volunteers ready to take your phone call there. Again, 1-800-HEY-KPFA. We do want to get back to the news, but it is critical that we hit these goals, because where else are you going to hear in-depth reporting on Congress rejecting a war powers resolution for the 7th time? Not just hear the vote tally, but actually hear analysis about what it means for constitutional authority, military spending, executive power, and the growing concerns many Americans have about endless war. Many concerns Americans have about how much money is in our pocketbooks. This is the kind of reporting we work to bring you every single day. And for the rest of this newscasts. I am so excited to hear from our intern, Kate Young, on an update on the Meta lawsuit. Our intern, Kennedy Cuello, updating on Attorney General Rob Bonta and investigating tax invasion related to the cannabis industry. And also our local news fellow, Annetta Felix, talking about health cuts in San Francisco. These are the stories we want to bring you, but we are breaking in because we have to pay the bills. This is listener-funded radio. No corporate donors, no underwriters. How many advertisements do you hear on other stations? You do not hear that here. It is a breath of fresh air, and you make that possible. So, folks, kpfa.org or by calling 800-439-5732. Zero callers on the line and one-fourth of the way to that goal. Scott.
All right. Once again, that's 1-800-439-5732 or 1-800-HEY-KPFA. You can also go online, kpfa.org. And let's get back to the news. A new study links voting across the political spectrum with living longer among older adults. It looks at data tracking Americans' voting behavior and official national death index records, finding voters were 45% less likely to die following the 2008 election. 10 years later, they were 37% less likely to die, and 15 years later, they were 29% less likely to die. Nadia Ramlagan reports.
Indiana University Associate Professor Sarah Conrath and her colleague Famita Handy at the University of Pennsylvania conducted the research. Conrath says it remains unclear why voters tend to live longer, but she has some theories.
I think there's a sense of purpose that comes along with voting, realizing you're part of a bigger community, you're contributing to the greater good, and all of those things can just make you feel more connected.
The study also found that those in poorer health to begin with benefited more from voting. Older adults already vote at higher rates than other demographics. According to AARP, in the 2020 presidential election, more than 70% of Americans age 65 or older said they voted, according to Census Bureau surveys. Conrath notes the American Medical Association has recently said that voting is an important social determinant of health. She says some factors in overall health fall outside of the typical list of things a doctor might ask about during an exam.
It's not just about whether you eat your vegetables or whether you smoke or not or how you sleep, but it's about your social connections and whether you belong.
She adds that like other civic engagement activities, including volunteering, voting may trigger positive biological responses that support well-being. Previous studies have shown volunteering can boost the brain's reward system and reduce stress. This is Nadia Ramlagan for Ohio News Connection.
Healthcare workers and community advocates are protesting sweeping cuts to the Department of Public Health. SEIU Local 1021 and healthcare workers rallied outside of San Francisco's last remaining mental health clinic for seniors, holding placards against layoffs, clinic closures, and calling on the city's billionaire CEOs to chip in. This comes as San Francisco Mayor Daniel Lurie's administration aims to close a projected $634 million budget deficit over the next two fiscal years. KPFA's health and well-being reporter Annetta Felix reports from San Francisco.
Yes, on D, tax the rich. Yes, on D, tax the rich.
Outside the Southeast Mission Geriatric Clinic in the Mission District, seniors and labor organizers matched with healthcare workers. They held life-sized cutouts of billionaire CEOs from companies including Uber, Comcast, PG&E, Gap, and Williams-Sonoma, whom organizers accused of funding opposition to Proposition D while the city cuts health services. Christine Hardy is the vice president for the SEIU San Francisco.
Our next billionaire that we want is shame from PG&E. Shame on Patricia. Patricia Pope makes over $19.8 million, which is 100 times more than the median worker. And Miss Patricia can avoid the tax from Prop D if she decides to pay herself 99 times more than the average worker. She doesn't have to go 100, but she chooses to. So with that being said, she's a greedy CEO. She's on our walk of shame. Shame, Patricia Pope. Shame, Patricia Pope.
Supporters of Prop D, like ER nurse Jason Negron-Gonzalez, shares the why behind shaming billionaire CEOs.
What we're saying is the people who are most able to contribute should pay their fair share to helping out the city in this moment so we can all thrive. And that's what property is about.
But officials say the financial shortfall is steeper, requiring cuts in public health services, layoffs, reduced staffing, and the closure of multiple community clinics like Laguna Honda Hospital and the Southeast Mission Geriatric Clinic. Hardy doesn't agree.
We're out here showing that we're not going to sit down and just accept this. They went about these layoffs totally wrong. They violated the charter. They violated our MOUs, our contracts. So we're out here saying, hell no, that you can't do this and you need to meet with the affected parties.
The Southeast Mission Geriatric Clinic has been operating for about 40 years. It's the last geriatric clinic in the city of San Francisco. But the cuts mean it would permanently shut down in August. Behavioral health clinician Leslie Manyweather is working her final months at the clinic.
We serve the geriatric or elder population ages 60 and above. And we have 60-year-olds all the way to 90. And we provide mental health services. We provide mental case management for them. We do home visits. We love our clients. They come here for community. They come here for care. They come here for love. Just sometimes they come here because it's a place to come to get them out of bed.
Patients describe fears over losing trusted healthcare providers and support systems. Karen, a senior patient at the clinic, says the center helps her rebuild her life after leaving prison.
This clinic has been very helpful to me. I paroled from prison after 30 years in October, and I'm bipolar, and I needed a lot of assistance and support, and this clinic is where I found it.
Negrin Gonzalez warned the cuts could worsen health outcomes citywide.
We've seen in the past when you cut healthcare services, people have bad outcomes, whether that's about getting sicker or passing away, unfortunately.
SF Mayor Daniel Lorry has until this Friday to lock in specific funding cuts before the formal proposal moves to the Board of Supervisors on June 1st. Reporting for KPFA Radio, I am Annetta Felix.
San Leandro Police Chief Angela Averett was placed on paid leave today after misdemeanor charges for hit and run were filed by the Alameda County District Attorney. At issue are allegations of Averett allegedly leaving the scene of an off-duty accident in May of last year. In an interview with ABC 7 Eyewitness News, Defani Ryan, whose car was hit in the crash, said she'd been driving in the far left lane around 11 p.m. with her husband and two children in the car when a silver Jeep passed her, quote, flying on the shoulder. She said the Jeep veered into her lane and clipped her driver's side mirror. According to Ryan, while the Jeep had police lights flashing in the rear window, after the impact, the driver turned off all the vehicle's lights, quickly crossed four lanes, and exited the highway. Speaking just before the Alameda County District Attorney was set to announce the charges, Averett denied the allegations.
Lauren Schmidt breaking in, as we only have 10 minutes left to make this match of our spring membership drive. And thanks to Anonymous in Santa Cruz and Shalene in El Cerrito and Barnaby in Santa Cruz, we are now halfway to that goal. Still have a couple stories we're trying to get in the news tonight. And folks, we want to get them in. Zero callers on the line trying to get this $500 match. Again, kpfa.org, where you can be like Barnaby and take home a bunch of KPFA bumper stickers, or you can call 1-800-439-5732.
State Attorney General Rob Bonta announced charges and an arrest following a tax evasion investigation involving tens of millions of dollars. The investigation alleges an unnamed individual laundered money and evaded taxes while operating 30 illegal cannabis dispensaries. KPFA's Kennedy Cuello reports.
Attorney General Rob Bonta announced charges in an arrest connected to a tax evasion investigation in Southern California. The individual, who has not been named, is accused of evading millions of dollars in state taxes while running unlicensed cannabis dispensaries in Los Angeles, Orange, and San Bernardino counties. Bonta says The suspect failed to report $80 million in taxable sales and evaded over $7 million in sales taxes between 2019 and 2022.
The charges we're filing include failure to file sales tax returns, engaging in business without a permit, money laundering, and white-collar crime enhancements. And I want to be clear about this. This tax evasion is not a victimless crime. When someone intentionally cheats the system and refuses to pay what they legally owe, the consequences are felt by all of us.
State Department of Tax and Fee Administration Director Trista Gonzalez described the operation, saying that it began with evidence of a point-of-sale system being used in illegal cannabis sales. The charges allege that the operation employed several thousand people at 30 unlicensed dispensaries. Gonzalez, along with AG Bonta, said that this investigation helps ensure the integrity of the state's legal cannabis industry because evasion at this scale is not a victimless crime.
The over $7 million in taxes the charged individual failed to remit could have supported critical public services, including schools, infrastructure, public safety, and community programs. Illegal cannabis operations also undermine licensed businesses that work hard to comply with California laws, pay taxes responsibly, and operate within the regulated market. When cannabis products bypass California's testing and safety requirements, consumers may be exposed to products that are unregulated, untested, and potentially dangerous.
The unnamed individual faces 50 years in state prison for 8 counts of failing to file tax returns, 8 counts of running a business without a permit, and 50 counts of money laundering. For KPFA News, I'm Kennedy Cuello.
Vice President J.D. Vance said today that the Trump administration is withholding $1.3 billion in Medicaid payments to California and threatening to suspend federal funding to other states that do not aggressively prosecute fraud. Serving as fraud czar, Vance said California was targeted over concerns it is not taking Medicaid fraud seriously, and warned that funding for state Medicaid fraud control units could be frozen nationwide if states fail to act. Vance claimed that the move was not politically motivated.
You may think, obviously, this is a Republican administration. We're all proud Republicans up here. You may think that this is purely a red state or blue state issue. That's actually not true. We see Medicaid fraud issues in Ohio, the state that I used to represent in the Ohio in the United States Senate. We also see Medicaid issues, fraud issues in a state like Maryland, which is obviously a very blue state. But both Ohio and Maryland have worked with us to take this issue seriously. They've worked with the guys behind me. They've worked with our entire team to make sure that they take fraud seriously. Again, this does not have to be a red state or a blue state issue. This is just basic good government.
Still, Vance named the heavily Democratic-leaning California, New York, and Hawaii as states not cooperating and under threat of Medicaid cuts. Meanwhile, in February, at the heart of the unrest over the immigration enforcement initiative known as Operation Metro Surge in the blue state of Minnesota, the administration paused hundreds of millions of dollars in Medicaid reimbursement funds after allegations by a conservative internet influencer of widespread fraud against a Minnesota social services program. You're listening to the KPFA Evening News. I'm Scott Baba. I am here with News Director Lauren Schmidt, and we are in the middle of a fund drive. We have a $500 challenge going that we have just a few minutes to complete, and we are still about $150 short. I know times are tough and every little bit counts, and we're not asking any one listener to try and fill that whole gap, but you know, whatever you can give, whatever you can get to us, you know, $10, $20, $5, whatever you can spare, that means a lot. You know, we want to let you know that we appreciate every little bit because we understand that, you know, we were talking about inflation earlier. We're talking about the economy, and things are pretty rough out there right now. And we know that it's hard, but
Absolutely. And I wouldn't tell anyone to do something that I wouldn't do. And that's why I contribute $10.
Yeah. So, Anthony McGinnis, you came by at Cicla Vida to give your donation to KPFK. Like, why?
Hey, the content on KPFK, nobody can match it. It's so versatile. I mean, it's diversified. I mean, I can hear my old school music, and I can listen to some artists I've never heard. They're in the community. They're open-minded, and I like that. The news doesn't seem censored, okay? So the news on there, the speakers, and all the young talent, that's amazing. I hear some artists that we should give more support to. I can see they don't go mainstream because they're struggling artists. We know that in L.A. And I appreciate KPFK for giving them that venue. Hey, we are.